past 11.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now we've come to the end of the Michael Palin diaries, the Python years. Today, Michael recalls how the Pythons reconvened in 1977 to make their most controversial film.
Wednesday, July the 13th, 1977. Some last-minute script work on Life of Brian, then drive to a group meeting. The changes and rewrites to the script are amicably accepted, but we have to agree on some casting for Friday's read-through. This casting, whilst it need not be binding for the film, could, as Eric put it, stick, so we have to make fairly far-reaching decisions between 12:45 and 1:30, when John has to leave. Eric tells John, Graham being out of the room, that we're of the opinion that John would be wasted as Brian and that Graham might be the best for it. He's Roman-looking, which helps, and was quite good as the central figure in Python and the Holy Grail. John erupted at this, far more vehemently than I would have expected. He hissed agitatedly that it would be a disaster. Take it from John. He'd been working with him recently, and Graham couldn't even find his place in the script. Then Graham reappeared, and despite John's outburst, it was suggested to him that he play Brian. Graham mumbled woolily. We went on to cast the rest. I was given Pilot, Ben, the ex-leper, and the follower Francis, as well as Nisus Wettus, the centurion in charge of the crucifixion. Terry J. Mandy, it was felt that a motherly ratbag was needed, and Terry's women are more motherly than Cleese's long, thin, strange ones. And Eric Otto. Friday, September the 2nd. A Python meeting at 11 to discuss what needs to be rewritten, if anything, on the Brian film script. Tunisia is decided upon for all the filming, so we set aside 10 weeks. We agree to meet and write and rehearse in the West Indies in January. Even writing this shocks me with its self-indulgence. Is this really the best way to spend our money? We part on good terms. The great thing about arguments over style is that they never really scratch the surface of our personal relations. We all know we need each other, and we all agree to differ. Sunday, September the 10th, 1978. As a result of having time last week to plan for Le Grand Départ, this morning's leave-taking is easier, emotionally and physically, than some I can remember. An enormous American limousine of the low, interminably long black New York variety swung into Oak Village and out stepped Dr. Chapman in immaculate light grey suit and, matching it and creating the final and complete effect of flamboyant elegance, was a light grey fedora. Never, outside of a sketch, have I seen the doctor looking quite as dashing. My last memory of the children is of Tom, Willie, Rachel in Helen's arms, forming an epic tableau in the back window of the Cadillac. It felt like an archetypal image of the native son off to the big city to find fame and fortune, except he wouldn't have left in a Cadillac. Monday, September the 11th, Monastir, Tunisia. Lunch on the terrace of the Sidi Mansour Hotel, where Terry Jones, Terry Gilliam and most of the crew are staying. Terry Jones had been struck down by some metabolic demon in the night and is still in a very delicate state. The art director is in bed with sunstroke, and a Dr. Chapman, with his napkin draped over his head as an improvised sunshield, has already been called upon to dispense from his apothecary's treasure trove. Saturday, September the 16th. The first day of filming. Went for a swim in the hotel pool, which was cool and invigorating, and shaved close. I have to play a woman today. Packed a bag full of script, towel, swimming trunks, black notebook, and 1930 Macmillan edition of Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, part of my cultural survival kit, and drove in my little grey Renault 5 along the road across the salt flats, taking great care to avoid bicycles, wandering old men, and dozens of women bottle-shaped in their white chadors. Finally turned in the direction of the bright, white, elegantly simple and unadorned lines of the Rebat. A take has just begun, and John Young, dressed in loincloth, is being dragged to the stoning yard beneath the outer walls of the Rebat by a wonderfully dressed, swirling crowd. It's an impressive, exciting, authentic biblical crowd, and more than anything today gave me a sharp boost of confidence. This film really could be impressive. A crowd of ladies in beards has been assembled from a nucleus of our rep company, Tunisian actresses, Tunisian non-actresses, and several people from Manchester who are here on holiday. John Cleese is a little stiff in his early performances, but loosens up as he realises it's going to be rather good. Terry Jones hops about in a businesslike way and doesn't exude any of the egomania of the great director. Monday, September the 18th. Tried some pilot oratory. I can really bellow here, and am happily screaming something like, "This man wanks as high as any in Rome!" When out of the emptiness a young Arab on a bicycle appears. He cycles slowly, warily, past me for a moment. Then, after he's put in a suitable distance, he takes one last look and cycles off like a man possessed. Never seen anyone disappear so fast. Enthusiastically closing the day with some press-ups, I feel a muscle go in my back. Curse my luck. Tuesday, September the 19th. Called today to be Francis, crawling through tunnels on the way to capture Pilate's wife. My pulled muscle was still painful enough in the night to jolt me awake two or three times, but it seems no worse this morning. We filmed on until 7, when the last platoon of Roman soldiers had tramped over our heads. Back at the hotel, Graham gave me some back rub. Graham's rapidly becoming a saint. He's been treating so many people in the unit, and now he's stopped drinking, he has time to do his medical work properly, without shaking or dropping whatever he's about to stick in you. In the evenings, Graham does his rounds, with pills and rubs and words of reassurance. His avuncular presence is calm and reassuring. In fact, John today suggested that Graham was reminding him more and more of a vicar. Wednesday, September the 20th. Up at 6. My first really testing day. The pilot forum speech. I know that I have to beware of factors such as being overawed by the scale and size of this particular movie. I have to try and forget previous successes or failures. I have to feel light and bright and free of any diversionary anxieties. Well, today I feel good and prepared and just downright happy to be performing again. We cover everything bar John's close-ups, then bring in the Tunisian crowd, whom we've heard outside the walls of the Rebat learning to shout, "We want Warwick!" They're marvellous. Terry Jones has this mixed bunch of Arab students, peasants, grandmothers, mothers with babes in arms, old men with missing noses, middle-aged men with almost leprous skin, lying on their backs and waggling their feet in the air. They find no trouble in jeering at the posturings of the Roman Empire and seem to enjoy it immensely. Friday, September the 22nd. Terry Jones' method of teaching an Arab crowd to speak English is quite a phenomenon. He was pressed for time, admittedly, but the Jones teaching technique went something like this. "Let's try it, then. We're all individuals." The good-natured, completely baffled Arabs mimic Terry as best they can. Terry, "Good, good, you've nearly got it. Once more, we are all individuals." Arab noise. Terry, "Very good. Now let's try, yes, we must decide everything for ourselves." Monday, October the 2nd. Today we're at Sousse, filming outside the city walls. No sooner is the leper shot done than the heavens open and a steady, unspectacular rainfall begins. Eric and I natter in Eric's caravan. Eric told of his father, who was killed in the war when Eric was 2. He was an RAF gunner, killed in a car accident whilst on Christmas leave, which is why Christmas was never a happy time at the Idols. John Cleese was judging a flower show near Weston-super-Mare as his father was dying. He didn't know whether to cancel or not, and felt he couldn't let them down. Monday, October the 9th. At the makeup house by 7:30. Emerge 3/4 of an hour later as Pontius Pilate in short grey wig and long white undertoga, and thus attired, pile into my Renault. A very gruelling day shooting the first pilot scene. The need to keep the vital giggling ingredient fresh and spontaneous made it harder to play. So I have to do a great deal of ad-libbing, and by the end of the day, I must have thought up over 20 new names for Biggest Dickest Wife, ranging from the appallingly facetious Incontinentia Buttocks to the occasional piece of inspiration which resulted in breakdown from the guards. Bernard McKenna did the nose trick spectacularly, once right down my toga. Sunday, October the 22nd. The children and Helen come to the location for lunch. Tom decided he'd like to appear in the afternoon's filming, so he was supplied with a long robe and turban and looked very handsome. He was the only one of the Python children to have a go. The room was packed, but graced by the presence of our executive producer and the man who saved the film after EMI pulled out, Mr. George Harrison. He took the part of Mr. Papadopoulos, the impresario in charge of the mount. At least Tom could say he'd been in a scene with beetles and pythons. Sunday, October the 29th. Hotel L'Oasis, Gabès. This morning I looked through an assembly of the film, from Pilate's Forum up to the Crucifixions, and was greatly encouraged. I'm not quite sure I'd go along with Terry Jones, who last night ventured to me that it was going to be a masterpiece. But having seen the stuff this morning, I feel closer to his judgment than to Terry Gilliam, who spread gloom and despondency over me on Friday morning as we motored out to the desert, with his analysis of shortcomings and missed opportunities. Night has fallen on the end of our seventh week in Tunisia. I feel optimistic about the film tonight, and less depressed at the thought of being trapped here for two more weeks. Tuesday, October the 31st. Yesterday morning I was hauled up on the cross. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation, but I was stretched out for half an hour or so whilst various takes of Big Nose were done, and I've numbed a nerve in my left arm and lost some control of my muscles, so the arm keeps rising involuntarily, rather like Peter Sellers' rogue limb in Doctor Strangelove. Thursday, November the 2nd. Today we spend most of our time and effort on the final song, which 24 crucifees sing as the climax of the film. I'm in one of the front row crosses. There's a slightly heady feeling, a tiny rush of vertigo, as I climb up onto the racing bicycle saddle, which protrudes absurdly anachronistically from an otherwise convincing cross. There's a certain sense of camaraderie amongst us all as we clip our nails over the top of our hands and push aching arms through the ropes. Among the few compensations is a wonderful view over the hills of Map Marta. Sunday, December the 31st, 1978, London. Life of Brian confirmed that Python can and should stay together, or come together as a unit in the years ahead. The recent BBC reruns of early Python shows are educating a whole new audience of young kids, for whom Python is still special, still unequalled in its particular field, and the presence of the Holy Grail in one West End theatre or another for over half the year confirms that Monty Python has legs. Next year, we'll have to live with the impact of the film. I know that although it seems that we just had a great deal of fun, both writing and performing, there's going to be something of a sensation when the subject matter is finally revealed.
Always look on the bright side of life.
And that was the last chapter of the Michael Palin Diaries, The Python Years. It was abridged by Loris Morgan Griffiths and produced by Louise Armitage. But do not grieve, gentle listener, for all across next week at this time, it's as though Michael had never been away as we pick up his second volume of memoirs. In Halfway to Hollywood, Michael recalls the 1980s, a frenetic decade full of filmmaking and rich in family life.
Hello? Ken Worthington, international impresario.
Ken, is John Shuttleworth here?
Oh.
I was just phoning to see how you're getting on, finding those programmes, for when I start as comedy controller on Saturday.
Not good, I'm afraid, John.
Oh.
I'm down in the archives now. I haven't found any of them.
You mean you haven't found any of the Tom O'Connor specials I wanted?
I have found some other programmes you'll like.
Well, I guess I'll have to do. Though it won't be the best of starts to my new job. What will my employees think?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can appease them by getting Mary to bake some fairy cakes to take in on my first day.
I think this is more of a one-off thing, actually, John.
Oh.
You're not actually going to be the new controller of comedy at the BBC.
John Shuttleworth is the comedy controller. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, this is Susan Ray. It's 3 o'clock and we're in the company of the Mumbai Chuzzlewits for this hour of drama in part two of Ayesha Menon's reworking of Charles Dickens' satire on the corrosive power of money, Martin Chuzzlewit. This is set amongst the Catholic community in modern-day Mumbai. Later tonight, in Fry's English Delight, Stephen Fry explores how the sea has provided the language with many of our most treasured expressions. That's at 6:30. Now, disinherited by his grandfather, Mickey Chuzzlewit escapes India and tries to make his fortune in Dubai. In his absence, the scheming Pinto and murderous Joseph join forces in an attempt to get hold of the old man's fortune. And while Thomas's feelings grow for Mickey's fiancée, Mary, a mysterious lodger with a terrible secret moves in next door.
The past has a way of haunting you. You can try to let go of it, but it may just refuse to let you go. Mickey Chuzzlewit came crashing into my life with the promise of adventure. And just as quickly as he came, he was gone. He called me once to arrange for his things to be sent to Dubai. But ever since, nothing.
Excuse me, you can't do that in here.
Where are you from?
India. You?
Moscow.
You like Dubai?
It's okay.
You have family back home?
My mother and my 2 girls.
Do they know what you do?
Here, stop here. You wait for me, yes?
How long?
20 minutes. Maybe half hour. What?
Okay. Wait! What's your name?
Anya.
Anya? Please don't go in there.
Why?
He hurt you last time. He could kill you this time. You have children back home who depend on you.
They depend on me to put food on the table.
There must be another way to provide for them.
Oh, don't judge me. You also are here to make money.
I'd rather starve than do this.
Maybe you don't know what it is to starve.
Anya! Hello?
Hi, Mickey. Still in Jumeirah?
Yes, boss.
How long?
I don't know. She's an hour late.
Good.
Shall I go get her?
No, of course not. Call me when you finish. I want you to go to the Sheraton after this.
What the hell with this? Where's the girl?
Who are you? Where is she?
Anya! Otri! Otri, who is it? Anya! Did you see the source of the mess in my